everyone, and welcome to another edition of Criminal Discourse Podcast. I'm Trish.
And I'm Wendy.
And back with you with our season 5 kickoff episode.
Woohoo!
I know, 140th episode.
That's a lot.
That's crazy.
Did you think you would make it this far? Honestly.
No.
No. But here we are trucking along.
Trucking it feels along. Good. Have a great case for you all today. I want to take a moment to give a listener shout out. And I hope I pronounced this first name correctly. If not, blame Google Translate. But Hafdis A from Iceland reached out to us and just wanted to take a moment and thank you for your kind words and letting us know how much you're enjoying Criminal Discourse and even gave us a case suggestion that looks good.
Is it from Iceland?
I believe so, yeah. I think it would be right up your alley. It reminded me almost of the Women of Ireland, the Vanishing Triangle. Ooh,
I was looking into some Iceland cases, but I got real intimidated by the pronunciation, so maybe relying heavily on Google Translator for that. We'll take a look at it.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yes. So thank you so much, Hafdis. I really appreciate it.
We had another listener reach out. We had actually had several listeners reach out over the break. We appreciate that. We love hearing from you guys. We had another one reach out with some updates on the Anthony Rowlingson case out of Queensland, Australia, Pittsworth, to be specific. Anthony is he was a teenager when he shot his older brother, Robert Rowlingson, and he's been in prison ever since. So we were wondering, it looked like this year he was scheduled for parole hearings. Possibly he might get out of prison. But this person who reached out to us, they wanted to remain anonymous, but they work in the prison system over there in Queensland. And I guess he hasn't been up for a parole hearing yet. They would be surprised if he got out right away, given that he hasn't really gone through a lot of the stuff you would expect, you know, like maybe anger management, any kind of rehabilitation.
Counseling
like
courses.
Yeah. He hasn't really gone through those motions. So I think it would be surprising perhaps if he got out. That's their opinion, but we'll have to wait and see. Sounds like there might be a backlog related to COVID and, you know, the normal process of the legal system. So we'll have to wait for more information on that one.
And I also have a case update, kind of case update adjacent. This story broke in mid-July that a federal judge found Dr. Henry Lee liable for falsifying evidence in a wrongful conviction lawsuit that sent 2 men to prison for 30 years. Mm. We've talked about Dr. Lee recently in the Hella Crafts case.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, she was murdered in November of 86. The trial for her husband started in May of 88. So this case that Dr. Lee testified to was back in December 1985.
Oh, wow.
So 17-year-old Sean Henning and 18-year-old Ralph Birch were convicted of murdering 65-year-old Everett Carr. And apparently it was a pretty bloody scene. Mr. Carr had suffered over 26 stab wounds. One of the stab wounds hit his jugular vein in his neck, so lots of blood. Dr. Lee testified that there were blood stains on a towel in Carr's home that linked the two men to the murders. So he didn't say it linked it to them. His testimony, I believe at the time, was that there was blood on this towel, or there was a substance on the towel that was consistent with blood. And the prosecutors made the link that that is the reason that there was no blood found on their clothing in their car. I'm not sure how they explained that there was no hair or fingerprints from either boy in the home. There was nothing that linked either of these two teenagers to the crime scene, but the connection was made for the jury that, well, they cleaned themselves up. So each did 30 years in prison until a judge vacated their convictions. I think one was in 2019 and the other got out in 2020. And that came about because their new defense attorneys had the towel tested.
Oh, retested.
Looking for DNA.
Yeah.
Like, okay, let's find out whose blood this is. Well, turns out it wasn't blood at all.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
Now Henning is, I believe he's 54, Birch is 56. They filed a wrongful conviction lawsuit against 8 police officers, the town of New Milford, Connecticut, and Dr. Lee. Apparently, and this is a direct quote from an article I read in People magazine. So in addition to finding Dr. Lee liable, the court also ruled the jury could reasonably find that both the prosecutors and the New Milford police hid or fabricated evidence that would have helped the teens in their case. So now Henry Lee, Dr. Lee, is 84 years old, and he has made a statement that he says he did not, he had no motive to fabricate this evidence, and that the test he conducted on the towel was prior to either of these boys being charged with the murder. He didn't even know them. And what he goes on to explain is that he had been called to the crime scene. He had done a field test on the towel to see if it was, it reacted to a chemical that said it would be blood. And he did that. And it showed, yes, there was a smear on the towel that had blood and one on the sink. And then it was collected for evidence. Now, the problem is it was never confirmed at the lab. And there's no evidence he conducted this test. There's no photographic evidence, video evidence, no paper trail that he conducted this test, or the lab did a follow-up to confirm that, yes, this is what the field test showed was correct. So Dr. Lee also says that, you know, 20 years later after this towel was tested, that the blood could have degraded enough that you wouldn't pick it up as a blood sample. But he claims that on the evidence bag, it is stated that this test was done. So he says, no, I did not falsify my statements to court, but this judge found him liable. And now the only thing is a hearing that will determine how much he has to pay these two men. Now, apparently, there may be a trial for the prosecutors and the police officer in the town if they don't settle. So I think the attorney general's office is defending them and will appeal this conviction. And so this, though, isn't the first time that Dr. Lee's come under a bit of scrutiny. He was looked at in 2007 as withholding evidence from the prosecutors in the case against Phil Spector's murder trial.
Oh my gosh.
For Lana Clarkson. By this time, he was an expert witness to be hired for defenses. And there were three witnesses that actually claimed they saw Dr. Lee pick up an acrylic fingernail in the foyer of Spector's home. And this is important because this would show, according to the prosecutor's office, that Lana Clarkson had held up her hand in front of her face when she was shot, and that's why the fingernail came off, and she did not kill herself. Remember, that was the defense for her, that she had come into his home. She worked at, the Hard Rock out there? She was a hostess.
Okay.
House of Blues. He had picked her up, gone back to his mansion, and she was sitting in the foyer when she killed herself. Long story short, he was convicted. He went to prison for her murder, and he, I think, has died, passed away since then. But it was a defense lawyer and a defense investigator that saw him do this, that testified that he had picked up this fingernail. And he's saying, no, they were mistaken.
They can't all be lying.
Well, the judge didn't think they were lying because this was the first defense team that Phil Spector had. I think these were what he hired first, and then he fired them for some other ones. So yeah, he didn't get charged or anything like that. Yeah. So that's interesting to see how that's going to play out.
He's very famous too. I think associated with the Casey Anthony trial. There's some very high profile.
He's O.J. Simpson. That's how he became known. So back when we're talking about these 80 cases in Connecticut, he wasn't as well known as he is today. He did JonBenet Ramsey. He was brought in on that. Phil Spector. Yeah. So he's had some very high profile cases.
Not even just case closed, high profile, but ones where the verdict was extremely controversial. And if we could look back at it today, it might be a different verdict.
Yeah.
That's very scary, the potential implications with this.
Yes.
But in the meantime, we also got a lot of, I think, exciting news over the break in the criminal justice world. We saw potentially at least one of the Long Island serial killer suspects is now arrested.
Crazy.
That's insane. I mean, I just feel there's so many positive updates, and then you get slammed with one of these with Dr. Henry.
Makes you question. Yeah. But, Long Island. Whopper. Yeah, that's going to be an interesting one to watch. I'm curious to see if we're ever going to hear about, and it might not come out till there's a trial or if there's going to be a trial, what evidence they collected from the home and the vault. Oh, and an Iceland connection, because his wife is from Iceland.
Oh, wow. We've never covered those cases, and there's a lot of podcasts that have done a great job with them. I'm excited to see what comes out. In that same spirit, we know there are so many true crime podcasts out there to choose from. We listen to them too, and you only have so many hours in a day. So we want to make sure and take a moment to say that we truly appreciate you choosing to listen to this one today. And if you want to join the discourse, you can reach out to us on our website. That's criminaldiscoursepodcast.com, or on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Criminal Disc Pod and Criminal Discourse Podcast. And one last thing, the views and opinions discussed on the Criminal Discourse Podcast are just our views and opinions. Everyone is presumed innocent until convicted in a court of law. Now we have to get into this one. I'm so excited for this case. Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So today we are exploring the chilling tales of individuals who have left an indelible mark on criminal history. In this episode, we unravel the perplexing case of Ira Einhorn, better known as the Unicorn Killer. Prepare to delve into the story that blurs the lines between charm and darkness, charisma and evil. Ira Einhorn was a charismatic and enigmatic figure emerging as a counterculture icon during the 1960s and 70s. With his eloquence, intellectual prowess, and involvement in the burgeoning environmental movement, he became a well-known personality in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So we're staying home state.
I love it.
But beneath this charismatic facade lay a sinister secret. And as we navigate through the intricate web of events, we discover the shocking truth. Ira Einhorn was not the visionary environmentalist he portrayed himself to be. Instead, he was hiding a heinous crime that would forever stain his legacy. Join us as we unravel the disturbing details of the tragic fate of his ex-girlfriend, Helen Holly Maddox. We examine the impact of Einhorn's flight from justice and eventual capture after living as a fugitive for decades. And we discover how Einhorn's life had connections to the Nexium cult. I know, I stumbled upon that and I was like, wait a minute.
That's exciting.
So our story primarily takes place in Philadelphia, the most populous city in the state of Pennsylvania. It is considered one of the most historic cities in the northeast of the United States, probably outside of Boston, I would say.
Used to be the capital, you know?
That's right. Founded in 1862 by William Penn, an English Quaker who believed in religious freedom. Philadelphia would play a central role in the founding of the United States of America after the Revolutionary War and the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, which was signed in 1776. Famous citizens from Philadelphia include actor and music artist Will Smith, basketball legend Kobe Bryant, comedian Kevin Hart, silver screen actress Grace Kelly, and singer Patti LaBelle.
Philly is full of lovable people, including lovable sports mascots. Gritty. I love Gritty. This is my shameless plug for Gritty.
Okay. So we're going to start by looking at the vibrant counterculture environment that defined Philadelphia in the 60s and 70s. Philadelphia at the time was a hotbed of cultural and political upheaval. The city became a thriving center for the counterculture movement, from the bustling streets of South Street to the bohemian enclaves of University City. Philadelphia became a crucible for change, attracting a diverse array of artists, activists, and free spirits. So let's start our journey on South Street. This is a vibrant and eclectic hub that epitomized the spirit of the era. Picture the colorful tapestry of head shops, record stores, coffee houses, and street vendors, much of which I think still exists today.
I hope so.
You hope so. Here, the counterculture movement thrived, drawing people seeking alternative lifestyles, artistic expression, and a sense of community. South Street became a haven for hippies, beatniks, and those yearning to break free from mainstream society. But the counterculture movement in Philadelphia was not confined to South Street alone. Across the Schuylkill River, University City emerged as a center for intellectual and social activism. The University of Pennsylvania, also known as Penn, Drexel University campuses became breeding grounds for progressive ideas, fueling debates on civil rights, anti-war sentiment, and environmental concerns. And activism played a significant role in shaping the cultural landscape of Philadelphia during this time. The city was no stranger to passionate protests and demonstrations, from marches against racial inequality to anti-war rallies in front of Independence Hall. Philadelphia streets echoed with the cries for social justice and change. And this was the environment in which Ira Einhorn emerged as a counterculture figure that attracted many and terrorized others. So Ira Einhorn was born on May 15, 1940 in Philadelphia and raised in a middle-class Jewish home in the Winfield neighborhood of the city. Einhorn had a look of a tough kid about him. He was a little over 6 foot tall and he had a very burly exterior. It is said his mother doted on him, while his father is to have thought of him to be a bit wishy-washy. In 1957, Einhorn graduated from Central High School, then attended University of Penn, founded in 1740 by Benjamin Franklin. And it is one of the eight universities in the Ivy League. Now, at Penn, Einhorn pursued studies in physics, but he excelled academically and demonstrated a keen interest in various subjects outside of his major. His intellectual prowess is what set him apart from his peers and earned him recognition among the faculty. So during his college years, Einhorn became deeply involved in the counterculture movement, which was sweeping across the country in the 60s. He rarely attended class, but is said to have studied beyond his requirements. He embraced the ideologies of peace, love, and environmental that were central to the counterculture movement, and Einhorn's passion for environmental causes would later become a significant part of his public persona, especially after traveling to all the counterculture movement areas around the United States. When we think of the 60s and counterculture, we think of Haight Ashbury.
Absolutely, yeah.
Out in California. That's what we think of. We don't necessarily think of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, but it also was a major hub here on the East Coast for the counterculture movement. Einhorn's academic success and charisma allowed him to captivate others and earn a reputation as an engaging speaker and social activist. He became a prominent figure in the counterculture scene in Philadelphia, using his platform to advocate for civil rights, again, anti-war sentiment, and ecological sustainability. And he would give free lectures at the Student Union Building to get his message out, and that's how he grew his following. So Harry Katz, an acquaintance of Einhorn's, met him through an underground paper he had started at Penn. And Katz described Einhorn at times as a man before his time. Einhorn was also known as a man who smelled. So it is described, as I described earlier, Einhorn was a burly man who now was sporting a very scraggly beard and hair.
Oh.
Yeah. He also had terrible body odor from wearing unwashed clothes.
Oh.
So this is how he stood out, though, and made himself unique. But friends knew that Einhorn would spend time bathing and keeping himself clean, sometimes hours. He would conduct his business from the bathtub. The smell, the ratty clothing and appearance, that just seemed to be part of the persona he used to shock and awe, right? To draw attention to himself. And in short, he was a performer who used his intellect and charisma in an egomaniacal way. That was his costume.
So a little manipulative, we're seeing right off the bat here.
So Einhorn didn't really have a job on paper. He dabbled in anything and everything that held his interest. His anti-government work protests led Einhorn to act as a bridge between the establishment, so big business, government, and protesters working to quelling rioting. So from his environmental work, he was invited to help organize the first Earth Day activities in Philadelphia. However, that didn't seem to last, as Einhorn was dismissed from the Earth Day Committee due to disruptions he caused at their planning meetings. So you'll see, some articles will even say the founder of Earth Day. That is wrong.
He was invited to participate and he couldn't even stay.
Correct. So the first Earth Day celebrations were held in 1970 across the United States. The purpose was to draw attention to environmental concerns of the time. So although Einhorn, again, is credited as being a founder, he wasn't. Now, he's never set the narrative straight, by the way. He'll take the credit. That distinction goes to Gaylord Nelson, a Wisconsin senator who in 1969 made a casual statement to the press that went viral. He said that Americans should set aside April 22nd as a day for discussion on how to address environmental issues of concern. So to not cut out Einhorn completely of the proceedings, because they knew he was a popular figure, they were holding the first Earth Day activities in Philadelphia's Fairmont Park. So they gave Einhorn 5 minutes to go on stage to introduce the keynote speaker, who was Senator Edmund Muskie, the author of the first Clean Air Act of 1970. Now, Einhorn, he had other ideas. And instead of taking the stage for his 5 minutes, well, he took 30, refusing to give up the microphone. And upon leaving the stage, Einhorn kissed Senator Muskie on the lips with what some say was his signature flamboyance, shock and awe. According to one Earth Day organizer, Einhorn was, this is a direct quote, interested in the publicity, how to make IRA better. He was going to play it for all it was worth. So Einhorn was also an opportunist on top of an attention seeker. So that doesn't mean it didn't work for Einhorn being his own public relations manager. Einhorn excelled at being extremely knowledgeable about current events and how those events would impact the future. He also talked about how important he was in bringing about this new age of thinking. So Einhorn even referred to himself as the unicorn, since his name Einhorn meant one horn in German. His bigger-than-life promotion of himself worked, as people, especially those in the business and the political world, thought Einhorn had the value they needed. And that led him to work as a consultant for large corporations such as Bell Telephone.
Wow. Imagine if you could do that today. Just someone obnoxious going on and protesting and big companies hire you to consult for them. What do the kids want? Well,
he played it for all it was worth. So most days, one could find Einhorn holding court at La Terrasse Bistro, where he sat center stage and conducted his business. Now, this is where in October 1972, 25-year-old Holly Maddox walked in the door, and Einhorn was immediately captivated. Holly grew up in Tyler, Texas, and was the oldest of five children, born to a Texas Highway Department engineer and a stay-at-home mom. Holly and her siblings were brought up in the strict conservative lifestyle, similar to most homes of the 1950s, and Holly was a devoted older sister to her younger siblings, whom she taught to swim and learn all the lyrics to the Beatles songs.
Good older sister.
So Holly, nicknamed Doodlebug by her parents, was a quiet, introspective, intelligent girl. She excelled in academics while also participating in extracurricular activities such as cheerleading. And in her senior year of high school, she was voted most likely to succeed by her class. Holly had what others described as mesmerizing elegance and fragile beauty. She was beautiful, trim, with honey blonde hair and an infectious smile. Holly's only difficulty seemed to be around dating. As her sister Buffy explained in an interview for the show Mugshots, which I have linked in the show notes, so in the 1950s, you could be smart or pretty, but not both when it came to dating, and hence the dilemma for Holly. She was both. So after graduation, Holly attended Bryn Mawr College in Philadelphia in 1965. Bryn Mawr is a distinguished women's liberal arts school, academically equivalent to those attending an Ivy League institution. So for example, to get into Bryn Mawr, one needs a GPA of 3.94. You're not even going to get looked at if your GPA isn't higher than that. So they're part of the Seven Sisters group of colleges. So that includes, I think, Vassar. We've heard of Smith.
So elite. She's top of the pack.
It's an elite school. So when Einhorn sees Holly enter the bistro, he immediately took a liking to her and zeroed in on her. As a friend would later recount, when Einhorn wanted something, he just went over and got it. And that's just what he did. And within 2 weeks, Holly moved into Ira's second floor apartment at 3411 Race Street. Now, I mentioned earlier that Einhorn referred to himself as the unicorn. And perhaps looking beyond the translated definition of what a unicorn actually identified as gives us a glimpse into what type of personality Einhorn possessed. A unicorn is an animal of fables who possesses a dual personality. One personality is exceptionally gentle and the other is fiercely violent, especially when cornered. Unfortunately, Holly would come to know both. So in the fall of 1973, Holly would call home to her family, telling them she was bringing her boyfriend home to meet them. But before hanging up, she told her dad he wasn't going to like him. And she was right. Holly's sister Buffy reported years later that Einhorn had a punky attitude and was disrespectful to both her family and to Holly. So upon arrival, the family sat down for dinner. And even before the family had been served their first course, had even put food on their plate, Ira was already finishing his plate and reaching for seconds. And then after he was done eating, he leaned back in his chair on two legs and put his feet up on the table. Now, according to Buffy, she said that's paramount to a criminal offense in Texas. I think that is offensive in any state or anywhere, but yeah.
And you said earlier about his dad being wishy-washy, and I don't want to blame the parents, but it sounds like...
No, a dad wasn't wishy-washy. He thought Ira was wishy-washy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he wasn't taught table manners, or he just didn't care, and he was doing this on purpose maybe too.
I think it was part of his shock and awe, and he didn't care. He liked to push people's buttons.
And maybe testing Holly too, like, can I do this to your family and you still...
Put a pin in that. And while on this trip, her family saw Einhorn treat Holly horribly. She acted more like a personal servant to him than a girlfriend. So this was not the Holly they knew. This was not the young lady that left Texas to go to Philadelphia. This was someone who didn't speak her mind, kept her mouth shut. There was no light.
Totally under his spell.
Right. So their relationship is described as rocky and stormy, with the couple breaking up several times, but always coming back together. And Einhorn, though, was not one who apparently believed in monogamy and would often hook up with other women, even right in front of Holly. There was one article I read. They were at a party and Einhorn turned to a friend saying, hey, can you make sure you can get Holly home? And he left with another woman.
Wow.
So in the summer of 1977, Holly and Einhorn took a trip to Europe, where Einhorn had several speaking engagements and meetings lined up. It had been reported that this trip was mostly paid for through Holly's savings. things. Now, Elizabeth Maddox, Holly's younger sister, had flown to Europe after graduating high school to meet up with Holly specifically. Not, she didn't like Einhorn. And Holly shared with her that she was over Ira and the way he treated her. She had finally had enough. She was planning on leaving him for good. And when she returned to the United States, she had plans to start up her own business. So Holly did fly home early from Europe, leaving Ira there. And Holly relocated to Fire Island, New York. And she even began a new relationship after some time. She was free, but still confessed concerns that Einhorn would not let her go, telling her new boyfriend and another friend that she was afraid of him. So at 30, though, she was reclaiming her independence and starting her life over. And she was really looking forward to it. Now we're getting back to the old Holly.
That was a long time for them to be hooked up together.
They were. And I don't think when they broke up, the breakups weren't like long-term breakups. So this next section, we are going to get into a bit more of a detail regarding the domestic violence issue that occurred in Holly's relationship with Ira, and more specifically, relationships he had previous to Holly. Holly did have a right to be concerned about this, given Einhorn's history with women who broke off relationships with him in the past. In 1962, Einhorn was dating a woman named Rita, and when she attempted to end their relationship, Einhorn strangled her to the point she needed to seek medical attention. Then in 1966, Einhorn struck his girlfriend of 4 months, Judith, over the head with a Coke bottle and attempted to strangle her when she told him they were through. Now, Judith had been a sophomore at Penn when she met Einhorn, who was now about 26 years old. Judith would testify years later that she felt Einhorn was domineering and manipulative. Einhorn attempted to isolate her from her family, wanting her to break off all contact with them. And in March 1966, after several attempts by Einhorn to get back with Judith, she agreed to meet him for coffee at a friend's place. So as she was walking back from the corner store with cream she had purchased for their coffees, she was attacked. Einhorn had been lying in wait behind a door and smashed a Coca-Cola bottle, back when they were glass, not plastic, over her head. He hit her several more times as she crawled across the floor to get away from him. He then dropped the bottle and put his hands around her neck with his thumbs on her windpipe pressing down. After a bit, he did stop, and Judith was still alive and she sought medical attention. She needed several stitches to close her head wound. Now, in both of these cases, no charges were ever pressed.
It was when she was walking back from the corner store. Was she still out in public? Or
no, she was coming into the apartment.
Back at the house.
Yeah. So in early 1977, Einhorn tracked Holly down and demanded that she come back to Philadelphia. He threatened to throw all of her belongings in the street if she didn't do so. So Holly did try to reach out to several people she knew to see if they could go get her stuff. But unfortunately, Holly wasn't able to get in touch with anyone and make those arrangements. So the man she was seeing was Saul Lapidus. And Lapidus asked Holly if she wanted him to go with her. And Holly refused, saying that she could handle Einhorn, that she would just go calm him down and get her stuff. And I think perhaps she felt bringing him would escalate the situation. Yeah. So on Friday, September 9th, 1977, Holly reluctantly returned to Philadelphia to retrieve her belongings. That evening, Einhorn and Holly went to the movies with friends, and that would be the last time anyone saw or spoke to Holly Maddox. Now, Holly never went a few weeks without checking in with her parents, and when they hadn't heard from her by Christmas, they contacted retired FBI agent, now private investigator, Bob Stevens with their concerns. Stevens partnered with another retired FBI agent, J.R. Pierce, who was working in private investigations in Philadelphia. And for the next year, both investigators would interview neighbors and friends, trying to piece together what had happened to Holly. Now, Holly's parents had also reached out to the Philadelphia Police Department about her disappearance early on, and the police conducted cursory inquiries as to her whereabouts, but they could find no wrongdoing. And since she was an adult, she was free to go where she wanted to go. And keep in mind, this is also the 70s. It is not today. We got to put ourselves back in the mind frame of the 70s. So according to Einhorn, when questioned by police, he stated, at first, Holly had gone out to the grocery store one evening to pick up tofu and bean sprouts, and she never returned. But then he said, in further inquiries, that she had contacted him a week later and told him she was all right and she would be in touch with him weekly, though he never received another call. So the police kept checking in with Einhorn over this period of time, but he would always be like, no, I don't know.
He played it cool the whole time.
Right. And they didn't know any of this. He had no record.
Right. So how would they know? If nobody called the police, if nobody filed a report, how would they know about those past girlfriends?
Right. So Stevens and Pierce met with Philadelphia detective Michael Chitwood in March 1979 and handed over all of their investigative information that pointed to Einhorn being responsible for Holly's disappearance and possible murder. Included in their documents was an interview with a Drexel University student who lived in the apartment below Einhorn's. He reported that in early September 1977, he had heard a blood-curdling scream and heavy banging coming from Einhorn's apartment. Now, he didn't notify the police as he lived in a neighborhood of frat houses and parties and believed it was related to one of those events. However, a few weeks later, he could not ignore the putrid dark brown liquid that began oozing down the wall from Einhorn's apartment. When he couldn't clean it up himself, he contacted the landlord, who in turn called a plumber, thinking maybe it's a, you know, busted sewage line or something like that. So when the plumber asked Einhorn for access to an area that was behind a padlocked door, Einhorn refused. So on Wednesday, March 28th, 1979, this is 18 months after Holly was last seen, Detective Chitwood, along with six other officers, three from the Philadelphia Mobile Crime Detection Unit, two police chemists, and a captain from the Homicide Division, rang the bell at 8:50 in the morning outside Einhorn's apartment at 3411 Ray Street in the Palatine Village section of the city. Einhorn answered the door in his bathrobe, which he left open, and he didn't have anything on underneath, and was handed a 35-page warrant to search for any and all evidence regarding Holly's disappearance. Again, that shock and awe.
I was just going to say, he's trying to shock them. And then they said, well, we've got a 35-page warrant to search.
Take time reading this. So when Detective Chitwood entered the apartment, he walked through the narrow hallway that held a small kitchen off to the left, past the bathroom, and then into the main room that served as both the living room and bedroom areas. He then walked through some French doors leading to a non-heated screened-in porch. Now, on the east wall of this porch was a 4.5 by 8-foot-high closet that had a padlock on it. He was going directly to that closet. Chitwood asked Einhorn if he had a key. Einhorn said he did not. Chitwood then told Einhorn that he would have to break the lock, to which Einhorn replied, do what you have to do. So Detective Chitwood then had photographs taken of the locked closet before he pried the lock plate off the wall so not to destroy the lock itself. Now, upon entering the closet, Detective Chitwood again had photographs taken that showed the closet crammed full of boxes, some of them with Holly's name on them. He also noted a faint, unpleasant odor. Now, on the floor of the closet was a green suitcase with a handle tag in Holly's name. Inside the suitcase were several items of clothing, four letters that were more than 2 years old. After cleaning out the boxes, a purse was found lying on top of a black steamer trunk. And inside that purse was Holly's driver's license and social security card. And while removing those items, Einhorn just stood silently watching. So the last item in the closet was the black steamer trunk, which was resting on top of an old folded up carpet. Again, there was a lock that Einhorn claimed he didn't have a key to. So once photographs were taken, the lock was pried open. And that foul odor Detective Chitwood had smelled earlier was now much stronger. So on top of the packed trunk were newspapers from the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin, dated September 15th, 1977, and the New York Times Book Review, dated August 7th, 1977. And below them was a layer of styrofoam packing material, like those styrofoam peanuts they used to pack things with.
Yeah.
Detective Chitwood then proceeded to scrape the styrofoam aside, starting on the left-hand side. And after about three scoops, he uncovered a mummified hand still attached to an arm, still clothed in a flannel shirt. Detective Chitwood then turned to Einhorn and said, it looks like we found Holly. To which Einhorn replied, you found what you found.
He's given him nothing.
So the medical examiner's office was notified, and Detective Chitwood went to the kitchen to wash his hands. And it was while standing at the sink, he noticed a set of keys hanging on the wall and asked Einhorn what they went to. And Einhorn replied, the lock she just broke. Einhorn was read his Miranda rights and taken into custody. So when Holly disappeared in the fall of 1977, Einhorn went on to live his life as usual. He continued to consult for major corporations and in 1978 spent a semester at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government lecturing. He also started to meet up with other individuals interested in how psychic abilities could be used to influence others or even be used as a weapon. Einhorn claimed that Russia and the CIA were conducting paranormal experiments, which he was privy to, and that was the reason He had been framed for Holly's murder. So on Tuesday, April 3rd, 1977, a bail hearing was held, and this was the day after Holly's funeral. Einhorn was charged with first-degree murder. Einhorn had hired former two-term Philadelphia district attorney and future senator to Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter, to represent him. And Specter lined up an array of individuals that testified to Einhorn's reputation as a kind and energizing spirit. A priest, a reverend, a vice president of Bell Telephone, college professors, various friends testified that Einhorn, who was now 38 years old, was a generous, peace-loving paragon and would never harm anyone, let alone someone he loved. So the judge, never having heard such positive statements at a bail hearing, was shocked, and he granted Einhorn bail for a first-degree murder charge at $40,000. And Einhorn only needed to pay $4,000 of it, which was put up by Barbara Bronfman, a Canadian socialite whom Einhorn met through their paranormal interests. Now, if the name Bronfman sounds familiar, it should. Barbara Bronfman at the time was married to Charles Bronfman, who ran, along with other family members, the Seagram's Distillery Empire. And her niece, Claire Bronfman, was a major financial backer and member of the infamous NXIVM cult.
Ah, there it is.
There's the connection.
Their money helped Ira Einhorn make bail and helped fund NXIVM.
We go. So Einhorn announced to friends and supporters after the hearing that he was looking forward to his trial in order to clear his name. Now, at this point, Arlen Specter did step aside. I think he was running for senator. And Norris Gelman took over as Einhorn's attorney. And his trial was scheduled for the winter of 1981, I believe in January or February of 81. So Einhorn had been residing in the Mount Airy section of Philadelphia before his trial and seemed to be keeping a low profile. So low, no one could get a hold of him, including his attorney in the days leading up to his trial. When authorities went to find out what was going on, they discovered that Einhorn had disappeared. He was now a fugitive from justice. Richard D. Benedetto was in charge of extraditions department in the Philadelphia District's Attorney's Office, and he immediately contacted the U.S. Marshal's Office and Interpol as to Einhorn's elopement. And it would be 3 months before the first break came as to where Einhorn may be. And this came from Dennis Weir, a professor from Ireland who, while on holiday in the United States, discovered just who Ira Einhorn was. Weir reported to authorities in April of 1981 that Einhorn had been renting a granny flat, like an in-law suite, from him for several weeks. When the professor told Einhorn he and his family would be traveling to the United States, specifically to Chicago for a family vacation, he said that Einhorn became agitated and told him not to talk about him, or he may be extradited. So when Weary arrived in the United States, he contacted the Philadelphia newspaper, who informed him as to why Einhorn was wanted in the United States. This is pre-Google. This is, unless you got an international newspaper, you might not hear about this in Europe.
Right. That's so pretty miraculous.
Yeah, he had no clue till he came to the United States. So when Weary returned home to Ireland, he told Einhorn, you have 20 minutes to pack your bags and get out. And you know why. So at the time, Ireland did not have an extradition treaty with the United States. So even if the authorities were contacted, they couldn't intercede. They couldn't extradite him. So Einhorn left and was in the wind again. The next tip as to Einhorn's whereabouts would occur 5 years later in May of 1986. Again, by Dennis Weary, who was now working at Trinity College in Dublin. He reported that he ran into Einhorn on campus one day. Einhorn was now going by a different name, that of Ben Malone, and claimed he was visiting friends on campus. Now, in the preceding 5 years, United States and Ireland had signed an extradition agreement. So now, D. Benedetto contacted the Gardaí through Interpol and as to the sighting, but they were unable to locate Einhorn in time as he disappeared once again. So you're making that phone call to Interpol. Interpol is reaching out to the Gardaí. The Gardaí goes to get him. He gone.
In the meantime, he knows that he's been caught.
Yeah, he's caught. He's getting out of town. So in September 1993, Philadelphia's assistant district attorney, Joel Rawson, decided to try Einhorn in absentia. The concern after 14 years was witness memories and wanting to get their testimony on record, not knowing if Einhorn would ever be found. So testimony given at Einhorn's trial included testimony from Einhorn's downstairs neighbor, the forensic testing that identified the body fluids that had leaked in the downstairs apartment was Holly's. They had ripped up the floorboards and the subflooring and were able to collect biological samples. There was also testimony from two young women, I believe they were sisters, that Einhorn had asked them for help getting rid of a steamer trunk. He told them the trunk's contents held Russian documents. Now, both of them refused. They're like, no. The trunk was brought into the courtroom for the jury to see. And the medical examiner testified that Holly had died from 6 blows to her head from a blunt forced instrument that had fractured her skull. Now, Gelman, Einhorn's attorney, objected to him being tried in absentia and did his best to get the trial dismissed. That didn't occur. And after 2 hours of deliberation, the jury found Einhorn guilty of murder and sentenced him to life without parole on September 29th, 1993. Now, prior to Einhorn's trial in absentia, Barbara Bronfman contacted DiBenedetto in 1988. She had been questioned a number of times over the years if she knew about his whereabouts, and she said she did not. However, this time she admitted to DiBenedetto that she had been helping support Einhorn while he was on the run. But after reading The Unicorn's Secret, Murder in the Age of Aquarius by Stephen Levy, she cut him off. She told DiBenedetto that Einhorn had been living in Sweden with Annika Floden, a Swedish citizen who came from a family of considerable means. Now, by the time Interpol was able to track down Floden and potentially Einhorn, he was gone. Floden reported that she was just his landlady, and she didn't know his whereabouts. But soon after that, Floden would disappear. In 1997, 20 years after Holly's murder, a Swedish woman living in California had watched an episode of Unsolved Mysteries featuring Einhorn. She contacted DiBenedetto and told him to contact relatives of hers in the Stockholm Police Department, who were able to track down Floden's identification number. So it sounds similar to like a social security number here in the United States. So when they ran the number through motor vehicle registration in Sweden, they got a break. In 1994, Floden had applied for a French driver's license under the name Annika Floden Blon.
Uh-oh, that last name.
On Friday, June 13th, 1997, French police officers posing as tourists and fishermen conducted surveillance on a quaint farmhouse in the small village of Champs-Moutons in the Bordeaux region of France. 2 days later, on Sunday, after confirming Einhorn's identification, they moved in. At 7:30 a.m., Annika, now 46 years old, answered the door. Einhorn, age 57, was lying in bed naked when the police arrested him. Einhorn insisted his name was Eugene Milan, not Ira Einhorn. Einhorn had changed his appearance over the years as well. He had lost 50 pounds. He had trimmed his now white beard and hair. Still, he may have tried to alter his appearance, but he couldn't alter his fingerprints. The unicorn had finally been caught. In November 1997, Einhorn attended an extradition hearing. Now, this hearing was to determine if he was to be sent back to the United States to stand trial. And what should have been a simple judicial hearing was not. Remember how Einhorn had been tried in absentia in 1993? Well, the French authorities didn't agree that Einhorn should be sent back to Philadelphia without having a new trial, with the absentia verdict set aside. The problem arose when Einhorn's attorney pointed out that based on Pennsylvania's constitution, Einhorn would not be guaranteed a new trial, as the statute of limitations had already expired to do so. So based on PA's current law, the French court denied Einhorn's extradition and set him free.
Come on.
You think you're frustrated. Holly's family was devastated. And after so many years of waiting to bring Einhorn to justice, here was just yet another roadblock. Now, Holly's parents didn't have to see Einhorn's latest attempts to avoid justice. Holly's father had sadly committed suicide in 1988 after falling into a deep depression over health issues. And Holly's mother passed away in 1990 due to emphysema. So Holly's siblings always hoped he would stand trial and looked forward to that day. And they were also forward-thinking and not wanting Einhorn to benefit financially from his life story. So they sued him. And they won a $907 million wrongful death suit.
That's good. They're going to get him any way they can.
And the thing is, they now know where he is. It's made international news. Mm-hmm. He could sell his story and earn money, right, for defense or whatever. And they didn't want him to profit from that.
Right.
So the Philadelphia district attorney at the time, Lynn Abram, got to work on changing the law so Einhorn's extradition could go through. In 1998, the Pennsylvania legislature passed Einhorn's Law that provided a new trial for defendants tried in absentia at their request. And in February 1999, extradition was granted, clearing the way for Einhorn to be extradited back to Philadelphia. However, Einhorn appealed once again to the French High Court, the Council of State, in December 2000. It would be in July 2001 his appeal was denied, and after 4 years of delays, Einhorn was on his way back to the United States. However, Einhorn tried one more tactic to put off his extradition, and that was by slitting his own throat. He refused medical attentions when doctors arrived, having been contacted by his wife, Annika. And you can see this in some of the footage that I have in the show notes. He's sitting at his kitchen table. It looks horrible. I don't know what he did, but it looks horrible. His throat is very open and raw, but he's able to speak. He's able to walk on his own to the back of the ambulance. So he didn't cut deep enough to do any lasting damage. So his delay was brief. And on July 20th, 2001, Ira Einhorn was extradited by U.S. Marshals back to Philadelphia 23 years and 10 months after Holly's murder.
I'd like to hear from those marshals just how good that must have felt to finally have him and be taking him back to Philly.
Yeah. So in September 2002, jury selection began on Einhorn's first-degree murder trial. Evidence presented at trial included testimony again from Einhorn's downstairs neighbor at the time of Holly's murder, to the screams and the putrid substances coming into his apartment. Testimony from the two women Einhorn asked to throw the steamer trunk into the Schuylkill River. They testified that Einhorn had told them that the KGB was out to get him because he knew about their psychic warfare experiments. There was also testimony from a South Street book dealer that testified that Einhorn was looking for a book on mummification months before he was arrested in 1979. Some of the most powerful testimony came from Einhorn's two prior girlfriends, who knew just how violent he could be. To back up their testimony, Einhorn's own diary entries were read into testimony. And this is one of those passages. This is what he wrote. "To kill what you love when you can't have it seems so natural. That strangling Rita last night seems so right." Another passage presented at trial was, "Where am I now after having hit Judy over the head with a bottle? Blood on my jacket and pants. Then making some feeble attempts to choke her. She wanted to live. That had been established. Now she will leave Philadelphia for good. I'll be able, if she doesn't have me arrested, to go back to living a normal life. Violence always marks the end of a relationship. It is the final barrier over or through which no communication is possible." So the defense put Einhorn on the stand, hoping to offer an alternative theory as to how Holly was murdered and ended up in the steamer trunk. Einhorn's defense was that Holly was killed elsewhere and placed in the closet sometime before March 1979 search warrant. Einhorn took the stand, possibly hoping that his charismatic charm would work in convincing the jury he was innocent. However, he came off as arrogant, putting on a show, blaming either the KGB, CIA, or FBI for setting him up. He stuck to his version of events in September 77 that Holly had gone out to a local co-op to buy sprouts and tofu and never returned, and he denied killing her.
So someone else killed her and put her in your closet. You had nothing to do with it. It was like you didn't know that that was her dead body in your closet all those years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. We can move on now just to make sure that was his defense.
Right. Wouldn't let the plumber in. Had no reason as to why he wouldn't do that. Why he didn't get the keys over to the detective. Yeah.
All right.
So on October 17th, 2002, a little over 25 years after Holly was murdered, Einhorn was found guilty of first degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Now, after the trial, one of the jurors interviewed stated that Einhorn came off as having a God complex, and the judge called him an intellectual dilettante that preyed on people. In the end, the peace and love persona Einhorn displayed in public could not mask the monster he was in private. On April 3rd, 2002, news broke that 79-year-old Ira Einhorn's hippie guru of the 60s and 70s had died at Pennsylvania State Correctional Institute in the Laurel Highlands, and he had died from a long-standing cardiac issue unrelated to COVID. So Holly's sister Elizabeth has been quoted in the media as saying, "The chapter is finally, for real, closed. I think a lot of people were waiting to hear that he had died. He had become part of the city's consciousness in an ugly way." So that is the case of the unicorn killer, Ira Einhorn.
I've heard so much about this case over the years that it has always kind of felt current, even though it really happened back in the 70s. But I think that's because it went on, you know, him being a fugitive, essentially, in the case, and then him dying. It's just always been very present. And I think sometimes, too, that he directed his violence at his intimate partners. But I look at him and I think of, I can't help thinking of someone like Jim Jones or Charles Manson, other guys of that era, that he could have also become some type of cult leader if he had really put his mind to, or even a Nexium type of guy, right? Like using these women that he pulled in for sex. I mean, he wasn't monogamous. So he was a horrific person. He was horrific to his intimate partners. He used people, he manipulated people, but it could have been a lot worse.
had he gotten away with it, oh, absolutely. But also on the flip side, he could have gone on to have a stellar academic career.
Yes.
He could be a sitting professor at Penn or Harvard or any Ivy League school. He was an intelligent man, but he used that intelligence to feed his ego.
Mm-hmm.
And he was horrific.
Yeah, it does. It makes all the things that he did that seemed a little bit good, as maybe he didn't really care about the outcome as much as he presented like he cared. It was more about his personal.
It was about him.
Yeah.
You know, the good came about because it gave him good press. So that is the case. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to listen. We greatly appreciate it.
Well, that's a great way to kick off season 5. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you want to learn more about today's case, head on over to our website, criminaldiscoursepodcast.com. There you'll find detailed show notes and all the resources Trish used.
I would highly recommend watching the mugshots episode. That gives you a lot more detail than I was able to put in here. And you get to see some of the people, the childhood friends, the investigators. You get to see the trunk and the packing material from in the trunk.
I'm also just going to put it out there for Netflix. They're Catching Killers series. I want to hear from those marshals who finally tracked Ira Einhorn down and brought him back. That would be a good episode. Now, we also invite you to join the discourse and let us know your thoughts on today's case or any other case that we've covered or that you're just interested in and you want to talk about. You can contact us again through our website contact page or by messaging us on social media. You can reach out anytime to tell us more about yourself, suggest a new case for us to cover. Just talk to us. We like to hear from you.
Yes.
That made our break wonderful. Hearing from many listeners. Now, if you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on. Leave us a 5-star review, especially if you're on Apple Podcasts. Those help a lot. And tell a friend so they can join the discourse too.
All right, everyone. And as always, if you see something, say something. You might have that missing piece of the puzzle it takes to solve a crime. Like the two young ladies that came forward and just said, hey, he wanted us to help throw this trunk in the school kill. And the bookstore owner who said, hey, he was looking for a book on mummification months before he was arrested. And even Bronfman, who had a change of heart. And she notified authorities that, yeah, I've been funding him. And yeah, you might want to check in this locale. And even the college professor in Ireland who came forward twice with his run-ins with Ira Einhorn. So thankfully, all those people helped put the pieces of the puzzle together to track down where he was so he could be brought to justice. And so before we go, remember to stay safe out there. We need to be kind to one another and we need to watch out for one another. So until next time, guys,
bye.